Hello and welcome to episode 48 of the Inside Elland Road podcast, your Leeds United podcast brought to you by the Yorkshire Evening Post. I'm Phil Hay, YP's chief football writer, and with me, as always, Joe Urquhart, YP's digital writer.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing, Joe?
Yeah, not bad yourself.
Very well, very well, after a good win at Rotherham, and ahead of very, very big game against Norwich this weekend. Let's not play that down. We've got plenty to get through this week. We're going to have a good review of the 2-1 victory down at Rotherham. On what was, I think, a big day for Bielsa and the players, a key game and a key result ultimately. We'll obviously have a look ahead to Norwich and what's coming up this weekend, what I think is going to be the game of the Championship season so far, without any question. A bit to touch on transfers as well, still waiting for Dan James to give us some white smoke from Swansea and potentially a couple of outgoings as well. And we've also got in the middle of this an interview with a coach called Ellis Riley, a former Leeds United Academy player in his younger days, who coaches over in America. And earlier this month was invited by Marcelo Bielsa to Thorpe Arch to observe a training session before Leeds United played QPR in the FA Cup down at Loftus Road. A 20-minute chat with him about what he saw at Thorpe Arch, what the training involved, a good bit of insight there into how Bielsa works and his philosophy and the way that he deals with the players. So that coming up shortly. But Rotherham, we said in the car down, definitely a game Leeds should have been looking to win, first against 21st. But after the defeat at Stoke and the fact that, without any question, Rotherham are considerably better at their ground than they are at anybody else's, it felt like a fairly crucial afternoon. And it felt like an afternoon where, if Leeds hadn't won or didn't win, there were going to be big questions asked. If they did win, it would set them up perfectly for Norwich and would probably right a little bit of the tension that was definitely present after the defeat away at Stoke.
Yeah, I think we all expected a battle, and that's what we got, wasn't it, for at least 50 minutes. I think Leeds were out-fought, out-battled, sort of everything that you were expecting Rotherham to come out and do. They did for the first half. A bit of magic from them. I don't think anyone was expecting that, and even Paul Wan said afterwards he'd never seen that from his side before. But that goal, when that went in, you were sort of thinking, oh dear, here we go again. But a great performance in the second half to turn that round. Leeds fully deserved it, I think, on the balance of play. Created so many chances in that second half, and I think overall a very pleasing result given the game that's coming this weekend.
The difference was quality, wasn't it? Yeah. I mean, what was very obvious in the first half was that Rotherham were so compact and so disciplined that every time Forshaw or either of the centre-backs were looking up with the ball at their feet, there was literally nothing to play to ahead of them. Directly, Hernandez and Cleek both tied up by Rotherham's midfield and defence. And really, for the best part of 45 minutes, reduced to difficult 30, 40-yard passes out wide, trying to pick out Alioski, trying to pick out Jack Clark, who was very quiet and was substituted at half-time. And, I mean, they do lack finesse, Rotherham, and they do lack that bit of class, but they've got a very honest and committed manager, I think, in Paul Wan, and they kind of embody his attitude. They play in the way that you'd expect them to play, given the way he speaks, given the way he seems to think about football. But you did feel in the second half that was what told. The move of Hernandez to the left wing seemed absolutely crucial. I think Roberts did his bit by drawing Rotherham's defence out a bit more mobile at number 10 than perhaps Hernandez had been in the first half. But once Hernandez got free on the left and the ability to just spray passes around, to pick his passes and to stretch Rotherham, the difference was almost immediate. And you could see with Rotherham that every time they tried to play the ball out from the back, it wasn't sticking with Michael Smith. There was no other outlet. They didn't have the ability to pass through Leeds or to get the pressure off. And granted, it took a top save from Kiko Kassia in the second half to stop Will Volks putting Rotherham 2-1 ahead. But I turned to Lee Sobot just before the goal went in and said to him, do you think this is coming? And he was kind of in two minds. He said, I'm not sure. And I felt at that point that it just felt like the pressure was too severe. There was too much on Rotherham. They were giving Leeds too much of the ball in a game. Got it done.
Lee was probably thinking about his holiday, to be fair.
He was probably thinking about his holiday in Tenerife, or potentially the fact that he hadn't backed Leeds in running, which he normally does when they go behind, and which we should all have done. And I have to say, I think I was sat there for most of the second half saying to you, I'm just waiting for this to get to 6-7, 8-1, potentially at the 90th minute, and then bang some money on, because you just got that sneaky feeling. But who should come up with the goals but Matthias Cleek? And how long have we been banging on about this, about the fact that since this song started and since everybody started to see him as a you know, as a go-to man for assists and for goals, it just hasn't been happening. And if ever a player needed the sort of unbelievably messy, scrappy first goal that he got, it was definitely him.
It's probably the worst goal he'll ever score. Although, is there a bad goal to score? I'm not sure.
It wasn't a bad goal in that sense, was
no,
it? But it's not by a long way the least skillful or creative that he's turned up for Leeds.
Well, I mean, even last week we were saying, weren't we, that he just needed anything to go his way, and it seemed to give him that little bit of mojo back. Confidence was booming, and he seemed to sort of be lifted by, even though it was, like we said, just a scrappy, horrendous goal. And to be fair to Rotherham, they started the second half better as well, I thought. And it was that little dawdle on the ball at the back that sort of gave Leeds the impetus to go on, because that, I think that was probably the first real attack of the second half, wasn't it? And when that went in, you could just see everyone in Rotherham's side, just the whole mentality just dropped. I was like, thinking, here we go again, we've battled for 50 minutes and we've shot ourselves in the foot almost. And it gave Leeds a real injection. I thought Jack Harrison was probably one of the better players, actually. That was probably one of his best performances since he joined, and I think he's actually benefiting from a little bit of a run in the team at the moment.
Particularly when he moved over to the right, he chipped away at Rotherham right the way through the second half, and his ball for Cleek's second goal. And it has to be said that the finish Cleek took from that opportunity was exactly what you'd come to expect of him in the first 3 months of the season. It was the fact that when the ball dropped to his feet, there was no question of doing anything else other than getting it under control, sticking it in the net, which I think is what's gone from his mindset over the last couple of months. That just that attitude or that kind of confidence that he is going to score or he can score. And again, popping up in those positions where he's so dangerous inside the box, those runs from midfield, which became a little bit of a trademark for him.
Well, I think we said at half-time as well, didn't we, that there was a little moment in the first half where the ball actually popped up right on the edge of the box for him to have a really good strike at goal. And he, again, sort of similar to the way last couple of months have gone for him, he dawdled on the ball a bit, and Alioski ended up shooting from like 45 yards.
A mile
as Johnny
wide.
Does.
Yeah. It was just that little desperate moment a couple of minutes before half time where you thought it wasn't panic setting in, but you could sense that the players were starting to feel that it wasn't going right. And Cleek said afterwards that they were all, Bielsa was extremely calm at half time, but the players were pretty angry about the way it had gone in the first half because it just wasn't clicking, it wasn't happening for them. There wasn't really any connection between the holding midfielder Forshawn and anybody further up the side. There was no space to play in, and it's we discussed this at the end of the game, whether it was the tactical change that made the difference, or actually whether the really crucial moment was the mistake at the back, which turned the impetus Leeds' way, and like you say, definitely got into Rotherham's heads, the feeling that they no longer had anything to defend and that they were going to be in for 40 very, very difficult minutes, which they were after that. But at the same time, Hernandez on the left in space and able to actually walk the ball yet again just made the difference and showed again why he, I think, is now the most crucial player in Bielsa's squad, bar none.
I think it was probably a bit of both, wasn't it? I think even Robert's introduction, obviously Hernandez really got into his groove in the second half, but just that little bit of directness and pace seemed to scare the crap out of Rotherham. And I think even Paul Warren said after that his two centre-halves weren't sure whether to stick in their shape or go and meet him on the run, and they ended up sort of being caught in between, and that's what sort of created a lot of gaps in behind when I think Roof and Alioski had two big chances sort of after the equaliser to get Leeds ahead. And as the clock ticked down, you're sort of wondering if it was going to come in the end. Obviously you were nailed on. I don't know why you didn't put money on it, but you were saying all second half.
I know I kept saying if this gets to 90 minutes and they run to something like 10-1, then yeah, money on. I think they were only 3-1 to win that game though at the point where Cleek scored, which again, if you'd been at the game watching it and watching the balance of it, you'd have had no question that it was going one way if it wasn't going to end in a draw. But I think there is that underlying confidence with Bielsa's team that they do manage to find a way regularly. Day before, Kiko Kassia, who I thought had a very good afternoon overall. It, in terms of being objective, it's only fair to say that there were a few moments where he came about 18 yards from his line to try and get crosses that he was never ever going to reach, and you did think, please don't do this. Yeah, it's not really what we're after. But his save from Volks was exactly what you'd expect of a La Liga keeper or a Real Madrid keeper. The movement of his feet was so quick, and to get across to that, because that was definitely in the corner of the net, there's no question. And it's funny watching the replays. I think it was Ford who was running in behind the shot, was celebrating it just before Kessié got his fingers to, and they thought it was in, the entire ground thought it was in, and it was the only moment, apart from Mejai's shot, which was unstoppable in the first half, where Kessié was really called into action in that sense. But it was different class, and I also thought there was plenty of authority from him in the box. I thought his distribution was quick and fairly brave in tight areas. And the difference I noticed between him and Peacock Farrell was the extent to which Kessié was trying to position himself and to play 18 yards out, if not further, to be as far from his goal line as he could be when Leeds were on the ball. And you do get the sense that there's a quality goalkeeper there, but also a very proactive goalkeeper whose full game, I think, will probably be displayed a little bit better against Norwich this weekend, given the way that game will play out.
Yeah, I think you can probably forgive him a few of those rash decisions. He's making his debut, I suppose. And there was it injury time when he ran out to collect a free kick, and it was literally on the edge of the box, and we were all going, no, God,
don't do it.
But isn't that sort of representative of Leeds United goalkeepers in the last 10 years, isn't it? But I think he sort of just, it's that little streak of that craziness that goalkeepers need, isn't it? It's just that, but you know, if he's made that decision in his mind, at least he's not caught in between, at least he's coming to get it. So there is that, but that save was incredible, wasn't it? I think Will Volks's tweet after was brilliant as well, wasn't it?
How's he saved that? Yeah,
I don't know.
Is what we were all thinking.
But it looks like a really good signing, that, and a signing that I think, and we've said it a number of times, but one that could really, really help Leeds in the second half of this season.
He's got that mean look about him, hasn't he? He's got that sort of,
and like you
slightly
said,
slightly mental goalkeeper look about him.
Sexy short sleeves.
Yeah. No, it has to be said. It's a long time since we've had sexy short sleeves in January away at Rotherham. Top class. But you're thinking now that this guy has the potential to be a long-term keeper at Leeds, which is something we haven't been able to say about anybody going back an awful long time. Rob Green had a very good season here, but at the time he was 37, 38, you knew you weren't going to get 4 or 5 years out of Green, and that, you know, he was as good as he was in that year, was definitely past his peak. And really, you're going back a long way further to find a keeper who felt very, very established, whereas with Kessié playing like that and looking like that, you do think there's somebody who, if he settles well and is anywhere near as good as he's been advertised coming in, could potentially be first choice going forward for a number of seasons, let alone a decent stretch of Championship games.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to the Rotherham game, he wasn't involved much at all in the second half. So for him to pull that save off sort of being cold, if you see what I mean, obviously he had a lot of touches with his feet and he tried to start play quite quickly with his throws and things like that, but any actual solid saves, he'd not really made any in the afternoon at all. But to produce that sort of is exactly what you need from a goalkeeper, isn't it? To the one moment that you need them in a game, to pull off a save like that was pretty bang on, and it's something that Leeds haven't been able to rely on for, well, like you say there, quite a while. And if he can keep producing that and keep getting better, and hopefully this weekend he'll again show at Elland Road what he's all about, then maybe it will be his for a long time. And like you say, it's going to be the first time for a long, long, long time that Leeds have really had someone at the back where you think we can rely on him.
Money talks, and he's on a very big wage at Leeds. He'd be easily up there with the highest earners now, if not at the top of the tree. I've quite a funny interview with him today where he was saying the first time he spoke to Bielsa after coming over, Bielsa basically said to him, "You're crazy coming here." Although Kessié could quite easily have turned that on its head and said, "Well, so will you." You know, I think both of them, it's a big surprise to see them playing in the Championship or managing in the Championship. Once again, we got a good tactical switch from Bielsa on Saturday, decision at the right time, which made a difference, and no break from the tactics which have served them so well right the way through. And it is, I think, quite fascinating the way that Leeds are able to apply the same game plan, the same strategy week after week, and also to trust in it and to see it work so often. There was no deviation at all, was there, on Saturday? They continued to press, they continued to pass, never ever going long ball, didn't panic at any stage, and I didn't get the sense from the players before Cleek's goal went in that they felt it was slipping away. There is really good underlying confidence there.
Yeah, I mean, it did feel at half time a little bit like if they don't come out and score early, this could turn into one of those afternoons. And at this stage of the season, it was really not what Leeds needed, I don't think, especially after the Stoke defeat and Norwich coming up. But like you say, to stick to those principles in that situation and come through the other side, I think a lot has to be said about Rotherham and how they played for 45 minutes. They did completely outbattle Leeds and physically dominated them. But I think as they sort of tired, and obviously the mental breakdown of conceding that goal, which was basically their own fault, wasn't it? Sort of all contributed. And then Leeds sort of just, as soon as, I mean, I don't think Rotherham got out the half for a good 10 minutes after the equaliser. They were just chasing shadows, weren't they? And like you said, you just felt that weight of pressure would surely win out, and it did in the end. And thankfully it was Cleek as well, who's been kicking the floor in under those circumstances recently, so good finish.
It's the difference between what Rotherham struggled to do and what Hull were able to do at Elland Road, which was to sit deep and invite pressure on, but to attack with some purpose and with pace. And that was the problem for Rotherham. They were very compact in the first half, and the discipline I thought was excellent, and they basically gave Leeds no space to play in. And in those circumstances, somebody like Matic was able to do a very good job on Joe Clark, on Jack Clark. They were able to stay very close to Cleek and Hernandez, but when it opened up after half time, you felt that they were going to crack, and so they did. We've obviously written and spoken a lot about Bielsa's tactics, about what he does at Thorpe Arch, about his philosophy and the way he approaches training, but we haven't ever had the chance ourselves to stand and watch the training session. As I mentioned earlier, I spoke to Ellis Riley on Monday about the training session that he went to watch at Thorpe Arch earlier this month. He basically spent a few weeks writing to Leeds asking if he could go and observe. He is a qualified coach over in the States. He's got his FAB licence, and I think at the age of 27 he's hoping to get his FAA licence in the next 2 or 3 years. He is himself a former Leeds Academy player, going back to a very young age, and spent a little bit of time at Scunthorpe, but is now working in coaching, and I think wants to pursue a long-term career in coaching. So I was hopeful of going to Thorpe Arch to see what Bielsa was doing, and to see his training methods and how a session is put on by what we all consider to be one of the most elite coaches in the game. We had a long chat about this. This interview is about 20 minutes long, but a lot of quite fascinating insight and a lot of detail about how the players were coached, about the way in which the sessions were set up. And first of all, I asked him just whether it was common practice or very regular for coaches like himself to be granted this sort of access to a professional club like Leeds.
I don't think that opportunity comes around too often, to be honest. Obviously for me, where I'm based in the US, I've got very limited access to clubs within a radius of 4 or 5 hours driving. So it's tough for me in that regard. So for me to get home and be fortunate enough to have the opportunity to go to Leeds, which is obviously my club as well, was a huge, an amazing experience, really. One that I didn't expect by any means, just because I think you touched on it earlier when we were talking about the blog. I did mention that my initial requests, I was told, you know, you'd be very lucky to get in and see anything over this period of the year because it's just our busiest time. So I'd been waiting actually about 3 weeks. I'd sent a few emails and letters of request in explaining how it would help my professional development in coaching. And I'd had to send some dates forward on days that I could potentially observe. And every single date I'd sent in had bypassed before I got this email, apart from the final day. So I got the email on the Friday to go in Saturday, and I was going back to the States on Sunday. So it all happened very quickly, but it was, obviously I was extremely happy about it, and a great opportunity for myself.
They said to you you'd be lucky to get in because of the Christmas period, but there must have been part of you that was thinking you'd be lucky to get in because it's Marcelo Bielsa who's up there at the moment and who's running the show. And I don't know, from the outside, you wonder how accessible. He talks a lot about people, about being quite happy for people to see how his team's training and everything else, but you still wonder how accessible his training sessions would be, how happy really in reality he'd be to have people looking on who aren't part of his core coaching staff.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't sure, to be honest with you. Like I say, it was my first time back in Yorkshire for 3 years, and I'd heard, just, you know, obviously doing my research and stuff, I'd heard, you know, some people, and I know people through social media who'd been there observing beforehand when he was at Marseille, and But in that regard, these guys were A-license, pro-license coaches, whereas myself, obviously being a college coach at the moment and a little younger, wasn't really sure how that would go. Like I say, I did write a letter of request, and then thankfully it was approved. And like I say, they seem more than happy to allow me to come in. I'm not sure, you know, how often they do allow people in. I couldn't tell you.
You said in the blog, and it's quite interesting this, that you were debating whether it was worth trying to observe the sort of methodical madness of Bielsa. What did you mean by that? Did you mean that whether or not you'd actually be able to take anything away from what I think are very complex training sessions, or was it more a case of whether or not he might just say no from the outset?
Bit of both, quite honestly. As you basically alluded to on your last question, I think the fact that it is Bielsa and the popularity around him this year, with Leeds doing so well as well, I wasn't sure if that would help my cause or not in writing a letter of request to observe. So ultimately it was just a bit of both. I was quite apprehensive at the, you know, at the thought of, well, if I write a letter and I'll probably just get it knocked straight back. But then when I realised there was some opportunity to go, then obviously things changed. And partially the methodical madness that I referred to didn't have a clue what I would be in for. And obviously when I got there, the day before QPR, it was a lot different as to what many coaches would probably see as a pre-game routine.
Can you explain why? What particularly stood out for you then? Because you've seen a lot of coaching. You coach yourself. You've seen a lot of coaches work. What were the things that really stood out for you?
Well, I think most interesting thing for me was as we got down to the actual main fields. There's about five fields set up already, just scattered in mannequins. Mannequins were colour coordinated for different reasons, depending on the situation they were trying to create on each field. But I think first and foremost, the fact that five fields were ready to be in use for, I mean, what were 27 players training that day? So as you can imagine, that's a lot of grass to be using on a pre-game session for only 27 players. And so I immediately knew that it was going to be a little different. It wasn't just going to be the sort of, you know, everybody out for a little warm up, when, you know, a few little passing patterns, and then into some shape, ready for tomorrow. It was a lot different to that. And as the players did come out, they were very quickly sort of split up into lots of little groups to train. So that was really interesting how they did that with a sprinkling of the U23s, under 18 guys. And they were all sort of sectioned off into different groups, doing specified pattern plays on each field.
Probably just worth saying at this point, obviously for the FA Cup game away at QPR, it was quite a young squad that Bielsa took down there. In fact, very young squad. So like you're saying, there would have been a lot of kids involved in that training session.
Yeah, it was quite funny, really, because the under-23s, if you like, Carlos Corberan had those. He only had six of them, because the rest of them were actually with the first team. And obviously, Carlos was coaching the first team in that session as well, but for the first sort of 15 minutes, he took six or seven of the U23 guys over to one field and did the exact replica pattern play as what some of the first team guys were doing in the same positions, just on a different field. So I thought that was interesting how they were literally copying the same dynamic. Obviously, in case any of these under-23s had to get drafted into the bench for the QPR game, and then they needed to know that role to a T. So it was very diligent, the way they were preparing for the game, just in the sense that you had, there's a few of the under-18s, there's only five of them on another field. And even those guys were working on the same pattern that the 23s and the first team were doing, just all on different fields. And I know I touched upon it, the coach to player ratio was, you know, I mean, it was probably like 1-3, which was really, really interesting again, because to have that many coaching staff available for that amount of players really allows you to get very technical on your coaching points within the session.
What about Bielsa then? I mean, he's got his four assistants. So he's got Corberan, obviously. He's got Diego Reyes, Diego Flores. He's also got Pablo Quiroga, who's been with him, you know, going back many, many years. What was Bielsa present, and what part did he play in it?
Yeah, it's funny actually. He came out about 15 minutes into the session starting. So obviously, Diego Flores, Diego Reyes seemed to run the majority of the session that day. In all honesty, they had those two had iPads, and a few of the other coaches had iPads surrounding them and tablets. And a lot of the work was based on the players coming in to observe, you know, a set pattern on an iPad, and then off they go to reproduce that set pattern play for about 10 to 15 seconds, and then they'd bring them in again. Or they'd tweak the pattern play if they weren't too happy with it. And but generally what they were doing were they were repeating one pattern about 10 to 12 times, and then they'd move on to a slightly different one. And I would say they only touched on three or four patterns maximum, but this spanned over the space of about 30 to 40 minutes. So it was just very quick, short, sharp, intense repetition. Again, totally against the mannequins. No live opposition in play, but they were really focusing on the points of the technical points of their passing accuracy, angle of reception, where their hips were facing. They were really stressing being oblique to the ball, obviously a diagonal angle. That was a very important thing that they were stressing. Most of the coaching staff touched on that at separate points throughout the session, trying to get the midfielders receiving at a very certain angle. So I thought that was really interesting.
Liam Cooper was saying to us a little while back that Bielsa had been very big with him on meeting the ball as you're moving, as opposed to standing still when the ball comes to you. And you mentioned that in your blog. You were saying that if you're not doing that, you're in trouble with him, really, because it's almost one of his pet hates.
Yeah, well, actually, as he was coming out, walking down, Lewis Baker and Tyler Roberts, and I can't remember, I think it was one of the other boys, were just three of them, were doing a passing pattern around five mannequins, and it was basically a 10 to 15-yard pass, and then a 10-yard sprint to a different mannequin to receive. It's just a triangulating pattern, it was really intense, and it went on for about 30 to 40 second repetitions. And that was Diego Flores and I believe it was Carlos Corberan who were both observing that one. And Bielsa was walking down, and there was a couple of moments where the passes just weren't sharp enough, and it slowed the whole tempo of the pattern down, and the coaches were straight in there, and they were just... You know, you have to move quicker. You have to get to this mannequin a little bit quicker. And they kept pushing the tempo. And you could tell, I just found it interesting why it was those three. But then, obviously, if you knew the way that Leeds were going to line up on Sunday, that made sense because, obviously, the way they played with Baker and Roberts in those sort of attacking midfield roles, That's how it translated on Sunday. But it was very specific just for these three guys. Adam Forshaw was underneath, that's it. So Adam Forshaw was the third player. And those three were just playing the exact same pattern around five mannequins. And this went on for about 10 minutes, and it was 30 to 40 second reps for about 10 minutes. And it just kept going on and on and on, basically until they got the tempo that the coaches thought was right. So I thought that was really interesting, how they just kept pushing that.
You mentioned the intensity there. They always tell us that they train under Bielsa as if they're playing, and that there is pretty much no break in the intensity of his training sessions. But how did that strike you, and how did it compare to what you consider to be a standard training session, perhaps under another coach?
Actually, I was quite surprised at how often they stopped the session. But I wasn't surprised by the tempo and intensity when they were live. I thought the balance was quite interesting. I think for every 20 to 30 seconds of high intensity work, they were probably 10 to 20 seconds off. And now it was very quick. It was come in, watch the iPad. This is what we're doing next. Move on. But again, the fact that this was a pre-game session, there was five fields rotating round, so players would go from one to the next to do something a little different on each field. And, you know, it also went on for the best part of about 2.5 hours, I would say, total. So, again, for a pre-game session, most of us in the coaching world would probably run about a 1 hour, 1 hour, 15 minute session pre-game with maybe 30 minutes analysis at the end to go over the scouting report again. But Bielsa had already organised a meeting for 1 o'clock and training started at about 20 past 10. So they were out there right until 5 to 1. Which again, as when you just look at the accumulation of time, it, on paper it looks like they've been out there a really long time, but they did repeatedly stop the session. You know, I would say the players were never working live for more than 30, 40 seconds at a time maximum.
Was it easy to understand? Because you touched on this earlier, the sort of methodical madness of it, but it doesn't sound, I mean, it sounds unusual and it sounds fairly unique, but it sounds like there's plenty of method to it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, the one part that I honestly didn't understand and I had to keep watching it was when they went on to their transitional shape, and that was sort of the main chunk of the session. So they set up the what they perceived to be the, I think, the QPR formation in the attacking half of the field. So they were working on Jack Harrison as the nine and the Leeds as sort of attacking press underneath him. And it was very specified because there was colour-coordinated mannequins. So, for example, there was nine mannequins that represented the QPR team, and the mannequins were colour-coordinated, so they weren't all the same colour. And what was very interesting was the coaching staff would call out a number, and the players would immediately transition from static to live shape in a transition. So, just for example, if they shouted number two, theoretically that means that Leeds were perceiving that the ball was going to the right back, so they would transition into that shape of how they were going to press the right back imminently. But then they had various numbers that they called out throughout the exercise, and what I found really interesting was just how diligent it was and how much information the players were having to remember at any one time. I mean, they would call out a number, and obviously for me coming in on that morning, I was totally unaware of what this number meant and what the shape transition was going to be. But it was very much second nature for example, Jack Harrison to shift to the left, 10 yards in 2 or 3 seconds, and then everybody else would shift underneath him. But the most fascinating part was when, you know, we've seen a lot of Leeds fans, even myself at the start of the year when we're watching pre-season, we'd be saying, well, what's Luke Ayling doing in the number 10 position all of a sudden? You know, because of the transitional switches that happen. And that was fascinating how I actually got to see that broken down, because I wondered how much of a method there was to that. And I actually got to see that, which was really, really cool to see.
I think I was saying in my column last week that the way you described it reminded me a bit of an NFL playbook. You know, of different moves in the same scenario, but different approaches and different plans of attack from essentially the same position.
Yeah, exactly. So what would happen, just for example again, is we'll use Luke Ayling as an example with him being the right back. As soon as a number was called, because they'd always reset their shape, they'd always kind of reset where the defenders were back around halfway. As soon as that number was called, the shape shift would happen. And just let's use this as an example. Luke Ayling would maybe move diagonally in 10 yards to the next mannequin. But that may have been where Tyler Roberts was just stood. And Tyler Roberts would then shift left 10 yards to where Alioski was just stood. And Alioski would then take Jack Harrison's spot, who was the number 9. And then Jack Harrison would maybe have shifted over to the right wing where... I can't remember who started there, but to the right wing spot, Jack Clark was there. And then Jack Clark would maybe be the pressure player on the ball if the ball has gone to the three, the left back. So very interesting how that shape shift happened, and it all happened so methodically in such a short space of time. And like I say, they would move for about 5 or 6 seconds, stop, reset, do it again. Stop, reset, do it again. And there was maybe 3 or 4 variations in numbers that they used for this attacking press. And it was all based on where they were theoretically placing the imaginary ball, if that makes sense, on the mannequins. So that was fascinating in a way. That was very interesting and hard to understand for the first 10, 15 minutes. I mean, I must have been making notes and notes about it. And then I think it finally... I finally started understanding some of the shifts, and once I understood them, I thought that's great. That's really, really interesting.
Did you learn anything new then? Because these days there are endless coaching manuals, and obviously people have never had more access to video footage and information about how to coach, and the, you know, particularly the techniques of elite coaches like Guardiola and Bielsa and others in the game. Did you come away feeling as if you'd had an education from that?
Yeah, in a way, and I think I also came away with a sense of just fulfillment in the fact that, just me personally, I've always enjoyed using sort of mannequins within pattern plays. That's just my style and something I've always enjoyed doing with players, because I think it helps them visually and cognitively understand certain patterns in a better way, because you're not against live opposition. And as long as you're pushing the tempo of play, everything else sort of becomes irrelevant, and I think that's how Bielsa sort of thinks in a way at times. And now obviously you have to go against live opposition within training situations to create a real game environment, but I really, really enjoyed just how much of it was mannequin based and how much was so diligently focused on this pass has to go within 1 yard to the right or left of this mannequin in order to find its target who's drifted behind the mannequin. And if it doesn't, you got to try it again, and you got to try it again, because obviously you hear, especially in coaching these days, you get told by a lot of people, even in the higher echelons of coaching development, well, mannequins aren't game realistic, etc., etc. But when you see obviously one of the most respected coaches in world football using it so diligently in his coaching methods, it almost sort of kind of reinstalled that belief that, well, they can be used, if used in the right way, to have a massive impact on your players and their cognitive understanding of the game and what you're trying to achieve within your style of play.
Just a final quick thought then. Was it easy to understand why this is working this season? I mean, we've got Norwich at home on Saturday. Leeds win that, they go 6 points clear at the top of the Championship with, you know, literally 16 games to go. Was it easy from that one training session to understand how it is that Bielsa is coming in June with predominantly the same squad of players that was left behind by Paul Heckenbottom, and has turned this team into a side who do seriously look like they're going to go very close?
Yeah, and honestly, you know what I think it is? I think it's... I do think it's, again, just touching on the mannequin work, I think because it's so specified, as long as there's enough time spent on teaching the players what he wants in each certain situation, they become so accustomed to doing the same movement or the same action within a certain scenario. You know, I mean, if they're transitioning into the final third and the number 10's got the ball, the 7, 11 and 9, they become accustomed to two or three very specific movement motions. And I think the more repetitive it gets, the easier that becomes. And so I think they're all on the same page. And I think obviously you've seen that this year within the squad, the way they've played. But it's come from the training field, and it's translated from there over this period of time. And it's fascinating how Bielsa got it to click so early. That's another story in itself. But yeah, you can certainly see why they've had so much success this year. Now, obviously, the other factors coming from behind against Rotherham at the weekend, quite honestly, I don't think it was a great performance, but they showed, once again, great unity and team spirit, which is something else that they really seem to have found this year, which, again, maybe the coaching staff have spent a lot of time working on that. But so it's not just the pattern play and the intense repetition of everything. I think Bielsa's done a great job in bringing that team together to believe. But as we all know in football, results breed belief. And with where Leeds are in the table, there's no reason why they shouldn't believe they're going to come from behind in every game they play, as it is at the moment.
The thing that stands out from speaking to Ellis, I think, is the detail involved, which doesn't come as much of a surprise, but you can only imagine it until you actually hear it, you know, spelled out in those terms, and it does become apparent, I think, why it is that it has worked so quickly at Leeds, because of the sheer amount of work that is being done, because of the repetition that Ellis was speaking about, the sort of focus on the individual training aspects and the way in which they go over it and over it and over it until it's clear in their heads and the players all understand it, and then by the sounds of things they go over it some more, and slowly you start to realise how it is that Bielsa has landed in June completely cold to Leeds, completely cold to English football in the Championship, and has turned pretty much the existing squad into a side who are top of the table by 3 points and could move 6 points clear this weekend.
Yeah, I think obviously we know the importance that this game's going to hold at the weekend, and I think it's no surprise that Bielsa, who we know and have sat in a presentation about his training methods, leaves no stone unturned, and it's all about drilling in so that it becomes second nature to these players. I think that's only natural. To be honest, it would be an absolute privilege to go up to Thorpe Arch and watch a training session, so I'm sure Ellis was very jealous, or causing people to be very jealous. But I think it's no surprise, is it, that a coach of his stature lives up to his name, I guess.
Yeah, well, the bit that interested me was when Ellis was saying he wasn't sure whether it was worth going because he wasn't clear whether or not it would actually be that easy to understand. And obviously the transitional aspect of it, he had difficulty reading completely. But I think in all, it sounded like a pretty enlightening experience, and you can understand why people would want to see what Bielsa is doing because of the number of people who've tried to emulate or copy a lot of his ideas.
The other thing as well is, like, the coaches at Thorpe Arch are getting to live and breathe this. Even sort of down to, you know, the youth ranks, but people like Carlos Corberan, who have been sort of welcomed into his inner circle that we've talked about before.
Yeah, well, it's clear how involved they all are.
Are all getting sort of this experience, so hopefully it can only benefit the club in the long run as well.
Well, if Dan James is listening to that, perhaps it'll be even more of a temptation to come from Swansea. We might as well move on to transfers. It's January the 29th. We've got just over 48 hours until the transfer deadline closes. Transfer deadline passes and the window closes. To date, one signing, which is Casilla from Real Madrid, but the one which has been bubbling for the best part of 2 weeks now and pretty intensely for the last 3 or 4 days is Daniel James, the winger from Swansea. 21-year-old who has 18 months left on his contract down there, and the player who, among the options put to Bielsa by Victor Orta, Leeds director of football, was picked out by Bielsa as number one target, and the player who Leeds have gone after in a big way. It's a strange situation down at Swansea because they absolutely do not want to lose James. He's a Wales international, he's a very talented player, they know what they've got on their hands, but they need money and they need to cut down the wage bill quite dramatically, and they're in a position where the high earners who they would love to shift off their wage bill don't seem to be moving, don't seem to be going, and it does appear to be crunch time really with James. There's a lot of, as we stand, still no deal agreed with Swansea, but there's a lot of confidence at Leeds that they will be able to do this and that they will get it over the line before the deadline passes. It appears that James is very keen to come. I don't think there'd be any problem at all with Leeds being able to match his wage or to give him what he wants salary-wise, and this will all come down to whether or not Swansea ultimately are willing to shake hands. But it does seem to be going that way, and we'll obviously look for developments in the next 24 hours. And something else to look out for if you're listening before Tuesday night's games is whether or not James is involved against Birmingham tonight, which I think will be a bit of a telltale sign for where this is at. We saw even Cavallero at Wolves linked last week with Leeds, which doesn't seem, at this stage, doesn't seem to have much in it in terms of legs. I don't think Wolves are particularly keen for him to go, and he'd be on extremely big money. If Leeds were chasing that one, you would kind of, it would stand out as an obvious deal, wouldn't it? You'd think, well, Cavallero did it in the Championship last season. He's a proven player. He's a sure thing, really. He would surely add to any squad in the Championship, no matter where they were in the table. It's quite interesting, I think, that they've gone so big on James, who is in his debut season at Swansea, who I don't think anybody would have picked out from a long list of wingers as the player that Bielsa would want. But he evidently sees an awful lot in him, and you can tell that he's analysed him closely by the fact, as we go back to the file about him was on the screen as Bielsa was doing his PowerPoint presentation at Thorpe Arch. He's obviously very sold on this kid.
Yeah, and imagine being him. You've been handpicked by Marcelo Bielsa to come to Leeds United and join this promotion challenge. How you'd be about 9 foot tall, wouldn't you, walking through the door at Elland Road if he does come? He might hit his head, actually, but you know, the confidence you would take from being handpicked by one of the best coaches in the world would potentially carry him through to finishing the season off really strongly.
And I think it explains why James would be keen to come.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, we go back to what we were told about Bielsa at the start of the season, about wanting to mould young players, helping them develop, bringing them in and trusting in youth. And he fits that mould, doesn't he? The quick, the pace. I think if Leeds can get it done, I'm sure... I think you just have to trust in Bielsa, and hopefully Leeds can get it done on the basis that if Bielsa wants him at this stage of the season, Leeds are top, just go and get him.
I get the sense that Leeds think there's going to be a deal here. I get the sense that they're very, very confident about it. Otherwise, I don't think they would be pursuing it in quite the way that they are with a couple of days to go. I think they'd be hedging their bets more. I think they'd potentially be lining up other options, which isn't to say that they won't have other options in the background, but they'd be lining up deals to a point further on than any are. And it's clear that their eggs are pretty much in James' basket, and that alone tells me that they think that at some point Swansea are going to buckle and are going to say, for the right price, you can have him. And I think any deal will involve a lot of add-ons. It'll be worth potentially a lot to Swansea in the longer term. I'm not sure the upfront fee will be anything like the figures that have been quoted in the past two or three days. But they want decent money for him. I can understand that, but I think more to the point, they need cash. And as much as they would like people like Wilfred Bony to be going, it has been a challenge for them to shift on players like that.
I think you're buying potential as well, aren't you? You're factoring in what you think Bielsa can get out of him potentially, and whether Leeds are in the Premier League or not next summer, whether his long-term future could be. It's not like they're chucking money at someone who has to be in the Premier League next season, is it? It's someone who potentially, if it all goes wrong this year, touch wood, that he can develop into a good player for Leeds in the long term. And I think Graham Potter's comments have sort of changed the last few days as well, haven't they? They've gone from, we're not even entertaining the thought of leading him, to, well, there's talks going on, we're not really sure. So that says everything, doesn't it? If the manager's starting to sort of side on that way, then...
It is largely going on above Potter's head.
I think Swansea fans are already saying they're really upset if this happens, which says a lot, doesn't it, about Swansea's ambition as well.
It does. I think it probably says more about their financial state, though, and it is going on above his head, which again gives you an indication of the fact that redressing the financial situation there is rather the priority at this stage. And whether or not they're going to threaten the playoffs, it isn't looking like it at the moment, and probably even less so if James leaves. But we will see on that one, and as I say, that is the one to keep an eye on over the next 24 to 48 hours, because Leeds determined to get that done, and I think as it stands, still very optimistic that they will. Elsewhere at sort of lower level, under 23 level, Mateusz Bogut's coming in from Rzeszów, if that's how you pronounce it, third division club in Poland. Should have checked that before it came
pretty
on.
Pretty sure I really saw him yesterday, but you've never seen anyone before, and you only first saw a picture of him 6 days ago.
he was pictured at Thorpe Arch, and as is modern culture, if you follow Instagram, he was pictured out and about in Leeds last night. That was basically done.
You were on Instagram?
No, but somebody tweeted me a picture from Instagram. I do have an account on Instagram with about 40 followers, but I don't get it. Apart from being a way to stalk footballers, because they always, when transfers are ongoing, they're always prone to Instagramming pictures of the plane tickets, and Sammy Saez did it driving along the M621 as he was arriving at Elland Road, and you think, thank you very much, nice and helpful. But that aside, no, I don't get it really. But I do at the same time appreciate that. Snapchat neither. No, it doesn't make any sense. But at the same time,
it's a young man's game.
I do understand that I'm very much in the minority, and old before my years.
Sorry, I don't really understand Snapchat either.
If you can call 30 old before your years, so he is in the country. That was just it was supposed to get done on Monday. It was just logistical reasons, and people need to be in the right place to get things signed off. But that one is done. That will go ahead. He is a development squad signing, but it sounds like already Bielsa is pretty keen on what he's seen, and as we've seen already, there doesn't seem to be any obstacle to getting into Bielsa's squad if you look talented and you make the right sort of effort. So it wouldn't be a surprise to see Bogut's involved to some extent in the first team squad, whether that's on the bench at some point or just in training sessions, but certainly hasn't been brought in just to coast with the under 23s. Harry Sacco, his loan deal at Las Palmas is at an end. They didn't want to keep him. He's hardly played. They didn't see any value at all of keeping him in the squad. It is unfortunate because he's such a nice lad, and I think his heart is generally in the right place. But in no way would I suggest that Bielsa should be trying to reintegrate him. I think you're looking for wingers who have end product, and that is really where his game falls down, I think, despite the unbelievable pace that he's got. So you spend money on James and you send Sacco elsewhere. There's been a bit of talk about where he might go. Larnaca and Cyprus were interested. Club in Hungary as well. There's a bit of interest from other sides in Spain. At the moment, I gather that he's going to Turkey for the rest of the season. He's going to join a Turkish club and move over somewhere close to Caleb Ekuban, I would imagine, although Turkey's massive, so potentially hundreds of miles away, but he will be in the same European vicinity.
Caleb Ekuban scored an own goal and at the right end inside a minute a couple of weeks ago.
Yes. Yeah,
that's incredible.
Claim to fame. It is. It is claim to fame.
It's one literally a minute apart.
One way to get in the papers. One way to get in our paper.
The loan watch.
Yes, Monday's loan watch.
Let's not talk about it. No
top
mind.
Top feature. Top feature. So Sacco will go. All being well, he'll head off to Turkey. I think the plan is as well for a lot of the fringe academy players to move elsewhere, to move on. I'm not talking about your McAlmonts and your Robbie Gotts and so on. It's your likes of. Oliver Sarkic, who aren't really in the picture anymore, who were brought in last season to kind of flood the under-23s and to give them some bodies and some numbers. They, I think, will trickle out as the next few days go on. The one surprise to look for at Leeds, which at this stage doesn't look like it's going to happen, but you wouldn't 100% rule out, is a sort of last-ditch move for a number 10. That was the one other position that the board at Leeds kind of sanctioned a move for at the start of the month. Bielsa hasn't really made any, hasn't shown any inkling of wanting that or needing that. But obviously there's still the issues about Izzy Brown's fitness and his return, and it is an area where Leeds do feel a little short of numbers. And I think despite his good performance on Saturday, are definitely making a makeshift playmaker out of Tyler Roberts, who himself thinks of himself as a centre forward. So that, I think, is the potential wild card, but at this stage I don't see that happening. There isn't any move for a number 10 as it stands, and we're clearly running out of time with the deadline due to pass on Thursday night. So when the window closes, and in fact before the window closes, all eyes on Norwich at home. I think we said a couple of weeks back that Derby was without any doubt the biggest game of the season so far. This is even bigger, and this might well be the biggest game of the season, given where both clubs are in the division.
They're all massive, aren't they, now? But I think this one takes obvious added significance due to the club positions, but also because of what's transpired in the last month or so off the field. We won't go too much into Spygate, but it adds another layer, doesn't it, of intrigue to what was already setting up to be a big, big clash. I think you sort of summed it up right in your piece today about it being sort of a heavyweight top of the bill clash, and it could be one that Leeds land knockout blow to Norwich. I think you mentioned earlier that they've got Ipswich next week as well, which alright, league positions dictate that Norwich should absolutely sweep them aside, and their recent record says, but it's a local derby, you never take those for granted, do you? So
I think emotionally as well, or mentally, it's always a tiring week leading up to a derby. And there'll be a lot of pressure on for that reason. I think people in Norwich will be looking for Norwich to give Ipswich an absolute doing, given that the opportunity is there. And Leeds and Norwich back to back, Leeds and Ipswich, sorry, back to back is difficult run of fixtures. Although Leeds go from Norwich at home to Middlesbrough away next Saturday, so again, it is starting to reach a pivotal stage. And we all noticed it full time at Rotherham that Bielsa, who generally tends to shake the opposition manager's hand and then just sort of potter away down the tunnel as he does without
and go straight to the press room, which causes us injuries diving overseas.
Absolutely, yeah, racing down. And apologies for those of you who listened to the post-match podcast and were wondering why there was a rave going on next door. The reason is that it was the away dressing room to the right of us, literally through what seemed to be a partition wall made of paper. So Salim Lamrani couldn't hear us, we couldn't really hear him, nobody knew what was going on, and in any case Bielsa didn't have an awful lot to say for himself after the game.
But the shortest presser he's done.
It was all one-line answers, wasn't it? He didn't really want to get into
fair
anything.
Enough, really.
But the one thing he did do at full-time was he turned round and he gave Pablo Quiroga, his assistant, going back years and years, a massive hug for about 5-10 seconds at the end of that game. And people have kind of interpreted that in different ways. Somebody was saying to me, perhaps after what has been fairly difficult 2 or 3 weeks of of kind of off-field scrutiny. It was just a relief to get that result on the board. But it felt to me like Bielsa knew how big a win that was and how big a moment it was. And you sort of sense that even he knows that this is getting to the sharp end now, and this is where it really matters. And I don't think any game has mattered up until now quite like Norwich does on Saturday, because we're talking about the difference of a Leeds win moving Leeds 6 points clear, a Norwich win moving them level with Leeds at the top of the table. It's a vital game, and it will make a difference.
Well, I think you're talking about someone who pours his heart and soul and his whole life into a football club. When he gets there, he's not a half-measured man, is he? Everything he does is 100%. So I can kind of understand that little bit of outpouring. Like you say, summed it up perfectly on the way back. It's like the equivalent to a knee slide, isn't it, for Bielsa? That
show,
or the David Wagner sprinting down the touchline, because we've never seen anything quite like that from him before, have we? He never even fist pumps, hardly, does he?
No,
that's the thing.
There was great footage of him during the opening game against Stoke, where Afobe scored the penalty, it had gone 2-1, so all of a sudden the game was in the balance, and then fairly soon after, Douglas swings in the corner and Cooper heads it in, and he was sat in his bucket and he just gave both fists, just a tiny little clench of the fist, and then, you know, totally absent of any emotion after that, and that's him. And so I think everybody felt it was quite telling that he felt that win on Saturday, or was prepared to show it more than he normally does, and I don't imagine it lasted for very long, but it was, as we said, at the outset of this podcast, it felt like a big game without going down the boring cliche of every game's a big one. It felt like a day when Leeds needed to demonstrate what they were about, and to, I guess, to kind of prove that, yeah, they were going to stick around in the top two, and that actually on days like that, it wasn't just going to all fall to pieces.
Well, not only that as well, being 1-0 down away from home somewhere like that, it's always difficult to get back into the game, isn't it? And I think Leeds showed a really good resilience to get back in there, and I think he was probably pleased with what he saw as well. So I think it was kind of, I don't know if we'll see, what will we see after the Norwich game if there's a win? Shirt off.
Rugby tackle on Daniel Farke after.
Should I mean, be a Spygate would be rather.
Yeah, I don't think Spygate is gonna ultimately be a huge backdrop to this.
No.
Christoph Zimmermann, the Norwich defender, was asked about it after their game against Sheffield United at the weekend, and he did kind of say, look, it's not a concern if they're watching us train. Everybody does, you know, does analysis, not necessarily in the way that Bielsa does, or you know, in this country, not really at all in the way that Bielsa does. But he wasn't making a big deal of it, and he said quite rightly, I thought it was a good comment, this. He just said, look, it's a case of who's better on the day. Who's better on the day, and this was true of the Derby game, who turns up, who plays well, which players do it individually, which team does it collectively, and ultimately the result will reflect that, which is kind of at odds to Norwich as a club instigating that collective letter to the EFL. I mean, it isn't the secret that they were behind it and that it was their idea, and given that they weren't the aggrieved party in the original dispute, it did seem slightly odd. And we'll not go on about the pink dressing room, which could be classed as slightly unsporting. I mean,
what about Neil Harris at the weekend as well? Or are we just getting into Mercury?
Oh, I can't be bothered with what about today. I can be bothered to say that what went on outside the stadium at Millwall should be a much bigger concern for anybody in the game than what Bielsa was doing. Bielsa's staff
getting slashed across
Derby's
the face.
I mean, that's, you know, that's really serious concerning stuff,
absolutely.
And you would like to think that there'll be as much attention paid to that, and, you know, potentially as much in the way of sanctions handed out as is going to come on the back of Spygate, but we shall see as that goes.
I can probably tell you now there won't be.
I did. There was a video on Twitter that somebody from the Sheffield United staff had posted. I think it was a member of staff from there posted of
the pink
dressing room down at Norwich. I mean, it's absolutely awful. It looks like what I used to train in when I was playing at the age of 7.
I think Sheffield United put like sheets of A3 paper across the walls, didn't they, in the Norwich changing room?
Possibly. There was some talk about Leeds doing that when they went down with...
I think they put loads of flags up.
With flags to cover the walls. But then ultimately Leeds wiped the floor with them anyway, trounced them down at Carrow Road.
The thing is, like, Leeds could just turn like the hot water off at the weekend. Does that come under good faith? Well, that's you just don't know. It's just such
they're weird, kind of old school rule. Tactics. I always remember when we went down to Colchester when Paul Lambert was manager there, and Leeds turned up to find that the dressing room they'd been in the year before was half the size, had been painted grey, had no plug sockets, and only had cold water. And it was a deliberate tactic on Lambert's part. I mean, the staff down at Colchester said that Lambert used to go out and listen to the music in the stadium to get it to try and get it at the right levels. You know, it was just kind of tactical obsessions and kind of fixations on things that sometimes you think don't really matter. But that dressing room down at Norwich is an absolute joke. As I say, it does look like what I used to change in when I was about 8 years old and playing for primary school.
But in all seriousness, if you're thinking about good faith, that's not acting in good faith, is it?
No, it's not. But then
I know
starts to boil down to sort of petty levels.
What I mean. So like, where does it start and where does it end? This. And we said it at the time when we did our Spygate podcast, and we're getting off track again, aren't we? Again, but where do you draw the line at this good faith rule and, you know, pink dressing room?
Well, I did say when we did that debate online about, you know, our thoughts on Spygate, I did say it wouldn't take long before Bielsa starting to see points of big hypocrisy, and you touched on Neil Harris. Sure. You know, that is the problem with the English game, is that it gets upset with certain issues, which then get completely contradicted, or at least people's attitudes get contradicted by what goes on elsewhere and the reaction to them.
I think Neil Harris just likes to take any jab at Leeds, doesn't he?
So, well, probably.
And that was just to tee it up and smack it out of the park when it was by gate.
So that will be this weekend's drama. Player to look out for them has got to be Teemu Pukki up front. A couple of years at Celtic, which kind of went by without anybody being remotely disappointed that he left in the end, but he was a free transfer in the summer. Left Bromby, available in Denmark, free agent, 17 goals, some very late ones as well, 98th minute, 93rd minute. They do that, Norwich, don't they?
I was just thinking that. Imagine if Leeds are like 2-0 up in the 94th minute, you'd still be going, oh God.
Yeah, is this going to end 3-2? Yeah.
Given their late shows this year from Norwich, they've had some serious rewrites, haven't they, and drama down there, so I don't think anyone can count the chickens too much about what's going to happen.
None as mental as Aston Villa away or Blackburn Rovers at home, though. I think Blackburn Rovers in particular takes the biscuit this season, although as we said, that was almost identical to what happened Norwich's game against Millwall down at Carrow Road. That was the same, trailing by a goal going into injury time and somehow turned that around. Pontus Janssen back from suspension, I think has got to start, don't you?
Yeah, should we do a Bielsa and Neymar starting lineup just to meet off the cuff?
Yeah, why not? Why not? Okay, you go first.
Kessié, Ayling, Cooper, Janssen, Douglas, Phillips, Forshaw, Click, Alioski, Harris and Roof.
I think you'll go Kessié, Ayling, Janssen, Cooper, Alioski, Harrison, Hernandez, Cleek. I think you might give Clark another
goal. Did I say Hernandez? I meant Hernandez over Harrison.
Hernandez,
sorry.
I wasn't even listening.
I meant Hernandez over Harrison.
Up front. This is a little bit like at Bielsa's press conferences where he lists the team, and by the time you realise that's what he's doing, he's already into
midfield. I've just dropped
Leeds'
best
player. You've missed whether Kessié's in goal or Phillips is at centre-back. It looks like you'll have Barry Douglas back this weekend. He played in the 23s yesterday. Stuart Dallas has a fractured ankle, so he's looking at another 6 weeks out, which just keeps this injury, long injury list this season, ticking over. The doubt at the moment, and none of us really know what the state of play is with this, is Pablo Hernandez, who wasn't going to be substituted at the end at Rotherham. It was going to be Tyler Roberts, but Hernandez put his hand up and said he had a problem of some sort, which Bielsa wasn't very clear about, but took him off. So got across everything Leeds that Hernandez is available. And will we see Izzy Brown? I mean, scored again for the 23s on Monday.
I've seen him.
And we're at the point now, I think, with Brown, where it's now or never for him. It's almost February. The season is so far gone that if there is any point to this transfer, and if he's going to make any impression, he's got to get involved at this stage. Otherwise, it's going to be mid-March, it's going to be April before he's even remotely fully fit, and at that point you're down to the last handful of games.
Well, if you're going off what Bielsa's saying, then it's going to be March before we see him, if he is going to need 8 games to get up to fitness.
It's not clear what he means, though, is it? It's not clear whether he means...
because he keeps changing.
Whether he means... It was six games, but you weren't sure whether that meant 23 games, and did that include the ones he'd already had?
So he's had three since he came back from his hamstring, which obviously 290 minutes and 145 minutes. I think it was 3.5 before.
Did he pull his hamstring on his fourth?
Yeah, I think that was right. So that's 6-7, if you're talking about 4 games, 4 minutes.
But interspersed by a month.
But interspersed by a month on the sideline, so... I don't know. I thought he was going to be on the bench for Rotherham. I was convinced after his 45 minutes at Tadcaster, and then Bielsa just completely shot me down last week in the press conference. So
I thought obviously Bielsa said in advance that he wouldn't be, but I thought Brown would have been right in contention to be on the bench at Rotherham, particularly lack of other players.
And the thing is, in the 23s, he drifts in and out of games, which is to be expected. He gets through games fine. He's not like, and he's. I think there was another challenge yesterday where he got crunched and he popped back up straight away. And he looks all right. He looks physically, in terms of battling and challenges and things like that, he looks ready. But
it was quite a revealing quote from Rob Price, the head of medicine and performance, last week. He did an update on the club's official website, and he said something on the lines of, he just needs to show the manager a bit more in games, he needs to show a bit more of what he's able to do. And you did kind of think to yourself, that might be the underlying thing at the moment. Bielsa needs to be convinced by him rather than simply shown that he is basically fit and ready to go. But in terms of
three.
No, he has. This is the thing. But in terms of this, of how this transfer is ultimately going to be remembered, he's got to start making some... I mean, look, if Leeds go up and Brown hardly figures, then it barely matters, does it? It's of no relevance whatsoever. But from what I can gather, he is now being paid by Leeds. He is now on the payroll, right, at Leeds, because he is essentially in first team contention, give or take. So you're looking for this one to kick in now, and you're looking for that option on the bench to be there, because, you know, there have been plenty of games this season where Bielsa has needed, you know, something to change a game. And obviously with Jack Clarke in the team, he no longer becomes the impact player from the bench, and it was Roberts on Saturday. But aside from Roberts, and you know, as much as Bielsa always seems to find a way, and you have to hold your hands up and give him massive credit for that, there was nothing else on the bench that jumped out as being an option to really turn that game in Leeds' favour. And actually, even Roberts coming on, you couldn't have said for certain that was going to work.
Yeah, we've said it before, haven't we? Having Bamford missing, and even having his presence on the bench, having Brown there, so I think, like you say, to justify, I don't know if that's the right word, but make this transfer seem like it's made sense.
Yeah,
he needs to start featuring soon, I think. And if it is the case that Bielsa's just not been quite convinced by him, then from what I've seen, I mean, I'm not Bielsa, and I'm nowhere near the same level as a coach of him, but I think he's just about there, from what I've seen.
Well, that's certainly one to watch this weekend. Also, Hernandez, we should get a firm update from Bielsa.
Sorry, he's not starting anyway in my starting lineup.
No, that's fine. Yeah, no, you can just watch from the stands. It's not a big game after all. But as ever, we will bring you the pre-match thoughts of Marcelo Bielsa, expecting his press conference to run on Thursday, even though it's transfer deadline day. And fingers crossed, some positive updates or some positive news on Dan James in the next 24 or 36 hours or so. But thanks for listening. As ever, we will be back with a proper podcast this time next week, where we'll wrap up the final events of the transfer window and look back at what will hopefully be a crucial victory over Norwich. Enjoy your weekend and speak to you soon. Cheers now. I'll always remember.